I asked James to start with a little exercise for everybody to experience technical rear training, as James has taught it at McGill for some years, and also is teaching it right now at the Band Center when he can. So yeah, James, it's all yours.
All right, so thanks Kirk and Amandine for having me, for having this. This morning's stuff was all pretty amazing and excellent to participate in. So yeah, I'll sort of start with, it's kind of a sort of fusion of like the first lecture I gave in the course that I was teaching at McGill, and just a bit more of a sort of broad look at what I think is important in the subject of technical ear training, and how it pertains to critical listening, which, generally speaking, critical listening is what we're all doing every day. And so I always kind of think of technical ear training as kind of, you know, if like a touring musician only ever played the gigs and never practiced, or if an athlete, you know, only ever played hockey and never did whatever, deadlifts in the gym or something. Like, it's sort of a focused training that's useless unless it's applicable to the actual performance you're aiming at. And a little disclaimer about the course I taught at McGill, the class size was 7 or 8 people. And so, you know, it was basically a one-to-one lecturer to student ratio for most of the time we spent together. So it's not a very practical model for larger programs or larger student bodies. So part of the angle, especially since coming to Banff, part of the angle that I have at it is that it's really, it has to be a self-directed, sort of self-study kind of tool. And so I'll give some sort of tips, hints, rationales for why I do this stuff, why I suggest other people do this stuff, and how. So without further ado, I will put up some pretty slides. Cool. So listening tools and tactics for sound specialists. So this is not your musical ear training. This isn't telling the, you know, difference between a minor third and a diminished whatever triad. It's none of that stuff. It's really just listening as if the whole world is made up of sine waves and pink noise, and everything you do is with filters. So generally speaking, when we're assessing sound quality, when we're doing our critical listening and not just our sort of subjective taste-based analyses of things, what are we listening for? Usually kind of breaks down into dynamics, distortions, spatial informations, and I've got timbre here, or sort of tone issues in bold. Because generally speaking, in every stage of audio production, sound professionals are constantly making timbral observations. I always think of it as like, Eliezer was talking about how when he was recording things, he's always trying to get it to sound the best in the room. And so he'll switch rooms before he'll switch microphones. And then he's trying to get it to sound best at the microphone. So he'll switch microphones before he switches preamps or throws on an EQ or throws on a compressor. So that kind of approach, to be able to do that, what you need to be able to do is stand in front of the sound source, memorize what it sounds like, go into the control room, listen to it through all of your transducers and processors, and say, how different is A from B? And do I like B more? Do I need to manipulate things so that B gets closer to or enhances more the sound of A, and that sort of thing? And then it's the same thing where we also want to develop our ability to quickly and accurately identify and evaluate tone color variations. So, you know, just like solo, if you put two mics up on something, solo one of them, solo the other one, and quickly say, I like that one, I don't like that one, we need to move something, we need to switch something. Because generally speaking, if you're not fast, you end up with a lot of free time on your hands because the artists have gone somewhere else. And because this process, this procedure is so integral to most of what we do as sound professionals, EQ is usually the first processing tool taught to new students. And I know in my history as a student of sound, EQ was the first thing I thought I understood. You know, I knew that I had no idea what compression was. And then I knew that I had an idea what compression was, but no idea what compression sounded like. And all of those things, you know, distortions and telling the difference between intermodulation distortion and, you know, harmonic distortion, all of those things were kind of just like, I'm staring at the tip of an iceberg and I know there's something underwater, but I don't know what it is. Whereas EQ, I was like, I turn up the highs, it gets brighter. I understand. Thank goodness. This is a picture stolen from a Sean Olive, so Harman International paper that they put out in 2008, which a lot of technical ear training instructors look to for validation. You know, I don't know if Paul and I are going to get into a cage match later on, but if it happens, you know, I'll be saying, but Sean Olive said that if you take a bunch of people, you know, 300 Japanese visiting students who just got off a tour bus, a bunch of magazine reviewers for audiophile magazines, a bunch of audio students, a bunch of all that stuff. And that's what all of the, is this mouse going to show up on this thing? I don't know. That's what, yeah, all of the sort of peach background stuff. And then this kind of dark purple background is a set of six trained listeners who went through an ear training program. And what you've got is four different sets of loudspeakers and people's preference on a scale of 1 to 10. How good do you like loudspeaker A? And they're behind a screen that you couldn't see through, but you could hear through. And so they couldn't just see, oh, hey, those are, you know, huge and shiny, they must sound good. Those ones, you know, are in S10s, they must sound like the 80s. They couldn't tell what they were listening to other than with their ears. And you can see that there are preference trends across a whole bunch of different population groups, different ages, different professions, different levels of sound expertise, from none to a fair bit. And you can see everyone thought the green speakers were kind of crap. Everyone thought the blue speakers were kind of middle of the road. And everyone thought that the pink and red speakers were pretty damn good. And it was kind of a question of taste, which you thought was better. And then you get the trained listeners. And of course, they're much more snobbish and derogatory in their assessment of the speaker quality. They say green was absolute garbage. Kick it out of the house. Blue was pretty much still just garbage, but better. And pink and red were like a 5 out of 10. So you can count on a trained listener being pickier, having a higher sort of, you know, standard of excellence. But according to at least Sean Olive's research and his ear training program, representative of the greater population. So it's not just useless. It's not just teaching people what I think is good so that they make stuff that I think is good. And then, you know, it doesn't sell because everyone in the rest of the world says, well, it sounds like crap, I don't care. The idea is that the training should actually help us be a stand-in for the audience that is gonna arrive at some point. So there's a bunch of timbral ear training programs. The sort of earliest academic one I know of is, back in Poland in the 70s, where it was like a sort of 3-year program. And then there's a billion kind of golden ears sort of packages that used to be sold in, you know, booklets of CDs. McGill, where I was a student, have had a formal graduate course since the 90s. And now if you just search, you know, on the App Store for whatever, there's a million different kind of like EQ trainer apps that have a varying degree of usefulness. But if there's one takeaway from all of this, I think it's how the trainee approaches the software that matters more than what the software actually does. You kind of have to bend them all to your needs to make them actually useful in the real world. So the goals when I'm teaching ear training are to expand your temporal memory and refine your sensitivity to relative timbre. So you need to be able to memorize what things sound like, and you need to be able to tell the difference between two things that sound similar with increasing speed and accuracy. I have this little note down at the bottom, isomorphic mapping. That's a term from Jason Corey's book. He wrote a technical ear training book that I'll show you a picture of, and we're going to go play with his software in a minute. Isomorphic mapping refers to taking perceptual terminology, or I guess taking sort of physiologically perceived phenomena and mapping terminology to them. So, you know, when you, everyone's probably had the experience where like an artist says, it just sounds too fuzzy to me. And you're like, does that mean it's distorted? Does that mean there's too much low mid? Does that mean, you know, it's too bright and they're just using fuzzy in a way that I've never used fuzzy? It's sort of being able to match that language and understand what people are saying and turn it into, I can grab a knob and change it. I can take a microphone and move it in a direction. I think is that's sort of the critical sound specialist ability. And then this is maybe kind of hedging my bets in a sort of round table debate we might be having later on. You know, the ultimate question is it a skill or a stunt? You know, is it, I'm smart, so I'm able to do my taxes better and, you know, win at cards for money with friends, or am I just fast at organizing a Rubik's cube? But it doesn't actually tell you anything about my intelligence. You know, does it actually help in our work? And so it's one thing to play like a technical ear training game and get better at that game. So a lot of technical ear training work uses, you know, one curated sound example that you listen to 1,000 times and see if you can hear, you know, what 1 kilohertz sounds like in the snare in that mix with this shape of EQ. And that's kind of garbage because it's not going to help you as soon as you leave that listening environment, as soon as you're not listening to that song. And so what I want from technical ear training is to get a greater understanding of how I hear things. And what tools I'm using to hear things. So it always needs to become something where I'm playing with the devices in the studio that I'm working in and seeing how they affect different things, or I'm translating my ear training work to crappy little earbuds so that I can, you know, if not hear the details in the music, I can hear what details I'm missing because of my playback situation, or different speakers, you know, my home system or a studio system. If we don't have greater understanding of our tools, we're kind of just, you know, closing our eyes and poking stuff. And I don't feel like that's expertise. It could be inspiring and it could be beautiful, but I also want to be an expert when I'm dealing with these things. The notion of a more stable internal reference, I'm always recommending to people who are having trouble getting their mix to sound the way it wants. It's, you know, find a tune that has a similar arrangement that you like the sound of, and not necessarily mimic that, but be informed by that. You know, a tune you've heard 1,000 times, if you hit play on it and the voice sounds crazy loud, maybe it's because you've been mixing your voice quiet all day. And the ability to memorize and the ability to have increased finesse in our recognition of differences will help stabilize that internal reference and will help us get more from our own internal references. And so a lot of my focus is on spectral listening, listening to EQ changes, but the same approach applies to compression, time-based effects, distortion. And I'll show you this Jason Corey's little free access online software suite where he has some tools for listening to reverb, listening to distortion, and bottom line, they're handy for isolating some variables, but we really need to just work with the tools we have. So like my favorite reverb at home and play with its pre-delay settings and exaggerate things so that I can really understand what it's doing and be faster in a performance situation, a production situation. And then this is a portable reference. If anybody hasn't taken an ear training course, this might be new to them. If they have, hopefully somebody's sort of given you this like crutch with which to carry an internal reference for frequency values and how they translate to things that we hear. My attitude is always split the audio spectrum into thirds, split those thirds into thirds. So you have kind of low lows, lows, high lows, low mids, mids, high mids, et cetera, at like, you know, nice octave intervals, which gives you this from 63 to 16 kilohertz, which is pretty much, if not what we can hear, often what our playback systems can handle. And then 63 hertz is kind of rumble. It sort of sounds like somebody's playing bass downstairs. 125 is the fundamental of bass frequencies. And then we use these vowel sounds for the sort of mid-range up to the low highs. I always think about it, if I was, you know, the EDM DJ in front of the whole crowd of audience, I'd be doing my like sort of my filter sweep before the beat drops. And it's just me going. And that sort of. That's roughly, and I'll show you in the software, it's a pretty good mimic of filtered pink noise, you know, band limited to 250-ish, 500-ish, 1K-ish, 2K-ish, 4K-ish. And if you get more finesse and you want to add third octaves between these things, it ends up becoming just sort of a like, my like 1K reference. A little flat will be 800 hertz. And then you get your sort of, you get back to your musical ear training with like sharp and flat and intonation. And then 8 kilohertz ends up kind of being a sort of shh, and 16 kilohertz is like a, and if the Zoom algorithm craps out on us, you won't be able to hear these differences. It'll all just sound like warbly monkeys, but we'll do a little bit of playing with some of this stuff. I'll open up the software, but does anyone have any questions about any of this stuff? It's all really just sort of preamble to here's an exercise you can play with to try to develop these skills more. I'll show you this little software suite. I like it because the software we were using at McGill when I was teaching that class was sort of a hot-rodded, modded version of this, but I also like it because it's free and not bad and you can use your own audio. A lot of them are pay me, a lot of them are crappy apps on a phone. So if it's free and readily available, rock and roll. So there's a question from Peter about mimicking bandpass pink noise in my examples. Do I also reference with sine tones? Not as much. And honestly, the pink noise, like I like to use myself as the sort of band limited pink noise generator, but I don't like to do exercises with pink noise. You know, you can.
If I go into this ear trainer and use the parametric EQ stuff, we can do some pink noise, and I hope it's not going to blow anybody up here. So that's my OOAAE. And then flat pink noise. And basically, I think pink noise is almost never a good, I'm hearing myself with a little delay, so it's freaking me out, so sorry about that. Pink noise is never a good reference for life. Sine tones are, especially if you're working in live sound, because feedback is going to be a lot like a single frequency pretty loud. So knowing where the sort of pitches are as an actual sine tone is useful. Mostly I'm dealing with recording studio stuff and like broadband situations and not so much with specific feedback frequencies. And what I try to do and what I try to get people to do when I'm training people with this is to hear, to be able to flip a switch where you turn off your musical listening brain and you don't say, oh, when I boost 4K, the hi-hat gets louder. When I boost 500, the guitar gets louder. I want you to be thinking, I flip a switch and all I can hear is filtered pink noise somehow. This is just like spectral information without any musical soul whatsoever. And I can listen to spectral changes in that. And then I can hear, like, it sounds like a thing, and then it sounds like a thing with more on top of the thing. And then I know I've added some 1K to that. So if I don't like that, I need to pull out 1K. If that's the good thing, I need to, you know, find out somewhere I can give 1K a hug. But hearing it as purely spectral information and being able to flip between musical, artistic sensitivity, balance considerations, and then pure Fourier transform frequency analyzer mode. I think that's an important skill to have, because it's so easy to get distracted by changes, like masking, removing masking, revealing something. So if I turn down the lows, it sounds like the highs got louder, but I didn't actually boost the highs. And tricks like that and understanding our perception, I think, are pretty key in moving past just being a listener into being a critical listener and a producer, like a manipulator of these things, a production professional. All right, so let's just look at this little software. So basically, this little software environment, this is just opens up in Chrome. It either doesn't work or it's garbage on a phone. I can't remember the last time I tried. But it lets you build yourself a kind of limited set of variables. So you can choose what type of the problems are. Absolute, I'll go into those in a minute, because they're not necessarily deal breakers. But your frequency resolution, you can choose octaves or third octaves. So if I go into third octaves, and once more, let's just use this pink noise, which is not informative. So this is the thing where there's, you know, 1K with a sharp and a flat. And that's, you know, going to increase your finesse with all of this, because it's not like our EQ options are only octave bands. You know, mostly we're dealing with parametric things, and if we're dealing with physical things and acoustic things, they're kind of infinitely variable. You can choose to be doing multi-band problems where there's going to be a boost and a cut, or two boosts in different places, and those just kind of get harder. You can choose how loud the boosts or cuts are, you know, and in combinations, if you want to start working yourself to say, can I tell the difference between a 6 dB change and a 12 dB change, and not just localizing where the change is, but how loud and how big the change is. You can narrow your Q. In most of my teaching, I just lived with a Q of 2 forever. And I have not done any sort of research or experimentation to see if changing the Q, all I know is that changing the Q is pretty confusing. And so it's probably something that's worth doing a bunch. But generally speaking, I find that if you've got a solidified internal reference for where the frequencies are and how big changes are, that translates pretty easily into a lot of real life situations. Then you can change your frequency range. So if you're using your laptop speakers, you know, like 125 is barely going to show up. It's probably just going to be a bunch of screws vibrating, 16K, 8K even, you might not hear. Or if you're just old, I remember trying this with my dad, and he could hear 4K boosts. And then when I boosted an 8K and I switched between that and flat, he was like, can't hear it. So then the main thing that my main quibble with all of these pieces of software is they end up being a piece of music that you just memorize where the frequency ranges are on that one piece of music. And it's not all that helpful in real life. So this thing lets you just drag and drop new files. So just drag, hit it, and it's a different tune now. Get rid of that pink noise. If I'm tired of that one, and you're gonna even just play with where the frequencies start sounding. So these examples might be garbage over the Zoom, because this is not a thing that translates very well to, you know, whatever 64 kilobit per second MP3 or whatever it is. But if you're going to use this, and I recommend you do, and we'll have an argument about whether or not you should, get yourself a whole bunch of audio files that you can play with and change them all the time. You know, only spend a couple minutes on one tune if you suck at it, because then maybe you're still learning. But if you start to excel at it, change to a different audio file, because in the studio or in the venues, you're going to be dealing with different sound and sound that's changing constantly. So, you know, I know some people who've, you know, memorized how the frequency ranges are represented by one Steely Dan mix in one studio, and that's just the Rubik's Cube thing. Hey, you're super fast at making a square colorful or less colorful, but it's not a life skill. No offense to anyone who's a Rubik's Cube fan. Any questions about any of this?
I had a question. Yeah, James.
Yeah, go for it.
A few years ago, I ended up using the Golden Ears training. How many actual, I guess, tools or programs have you sort of gone through yourself?
I mean, start to finish, like none, I guess.
Oh, not like all the way through, because I mean, I didn't make it all the way through. I made it, I don't know, I don't even remember really.
Yeah.
In terms of exposure, I guess.
I've poked many of them for just a couple moments, and on anything more complex than EQ listening, I find I got to build my own exercises. I got to open up a Pro Tools session and find a snare loop and start playing with settings on a compressor or something like that. Right. Because almost always, you know, EQ, like transparent EQs, are a big portion of the EQ processor market, and they're fairly similar. But things like compressors, as soon as you're like, I'm using the, you know, Avid channel strip version of a compressor, I'm using the Bomb Factory emulation of a piece of hardware that's an emulation of a piece of hardware, you know, plugging all of those, it's like, there's only so much you can get from, like, you know, drawing stick figures when your eventual goal is, you know, to paint a portrait. But I find them really inspiring for coming up with listening and ear training exercises to build for myself.
Okay, so it's like a creative, I guess, autodidactic kind of
learning. I really think thing. So. Yeah. And my like analogy before of, you know, a concert musician who never practices at home, like I find that we tend to do that. Like craftspeople tend to do that. I'm not gonna open up a Pro Tools session with a drum track and just play with compressors for an hour at home because, you know, tomorrow I've got to go into the studio or whatever. But it's like, no, we totally should all the time. And like anytime you're, you know, developing a facility with a new tool, you should be trying to break that tool and like seeing what the extremes of it do to help understand it. So that when we get into a real use scenario with clients or with, you know, co-creatives or whatever we're doing, we get to use those tools. We're not figuring out how to use the tools. We're figuring out how we want to use the tools.
Right. Cool. Thanks.